what do you call it? I'm sorry. I was looking up. I walked on the other side of the room to pick up my kufi. I had never heard that all the islands of the Philippines were Muslim before Magellan came. I know that the Spaniards forced Catholicism on them, but I hadn't known that the whole place was Muslim. I can imagine so. They have izars. They wear izars. And they very big warrior culture. A lot of people don't realize that the martial arts in the Philippines is more deadlier than the martial arts in China. You know, like the one that. Okay, so like in the military, the Marine Corps, I should say, has a distinct rule that I don't know if the rest of the services do have. I'm pretty sure they do not. But what the Marine Corps does, the United States Marine Corps, if they find another army or people that has qualities or skills that they feel they could inculcate into their own military, then the Marine Corps rule is to learn that and put that together into their martial arts, their culture, the Marine culture. You see this particularly in the sword that you see the Muslims wear. I'm sorry, the Marines wearing. Anybody know the origins of that sword? That, you know, every serviceman, officer, we get issued a sword. Anybody notice the sword, the Marine Corps sword?
Yes. No, I've never noticed it.
Okay.
I noticed that before. What about
you? Okay, I was going to say, Tyler Boyd, you shouldn't be noticing because you're in the Philippines, so you should pay attention to that. Now, what's that sword look like to you?
Isn't it just like a thin sword?
It is a thin sword. Very much so. Okay, it's a thin sword, but it is a broad sword at the same time. It's not a French foil, okay, which was the thing that the Western Europeans had. They had foils. Okay, the French did at least. That sword comes from the Mamluk soldiers, the Mamluk Muslim warriors of North Africa, and in particular Salah ad-Din, you know, made famous by Salah ad-Din and the people in Egypt, the ones who took down the Genghis Khan and everything at the Battle of Ain al-Jalut. Okay, so it's a curved Muslim sword. The reason why it's thin, which is different from the ones that the crusaders used, and which is more what you find in the army, this really wider, broader sword like that, is because it uses Indian metal, Indian and Damascus steel. And the only ones that used Indian and Damascus steel were the Muslims. And Indian and Damascus steel is lighter but stronger than the crusader metal. So you find that the crusaders, they carried these big, long, broad swords, and the Vikings and stuff. Like, Vikings usually didn't carry swords, though, but later on, the Germans, they did. Because initially, the Germans, what they carried was, and those people from the north, they carried hatchets. They went to battle with axes and stuff like that, battle axes and stuff like that. But when they did adopt swords, they were these huge two-handed swords that you couldn't wield with one hand. But the Muslims could fight you off with a one-handed thinner sword. Why? Because the metal was lighter but stronger. And they used a curved sword. That was indicative of the moon, the crescent, you know, but that's not why they had it curved. Kufar thought that was why, but it was curved because of the science behind the cut. You know, when you cut with a curved sword, it cuts deeper by the time it gets to the end of the swing. But the Kufar didn't catch on to that till much later. So you find that there. Also, what the Marine Corps did was when it went to the Philippines and dealt with, had to fight with the Filipino people or deal with the Filipino people. The, you know, the Filipinos never stopped fighting. Even after the war was over, they just kept fighting. They didn't
That's
even
right.
realize it.
Yeah.
They didn't realize it. Okay. You call a truce. So what? You're still here. We're going to keep fighting you. And I think they fought, like, I think it was, I forget the amount of time, but it was, they kept fighting. That was one of those military anomalies that they talk about in military history. But their martial arts has been adopted into the Marine Corps, the particularly Filipino martial arts style. You sometimes people call it Cali, and we have some other names for it, but really it's the double sticks. You have two sticks, and also there's another one with stick and knife. Okay? And these are like very dangerous style of weapon fighting. And it's like the only style that the Marine Corps teaches because it's so practical. You know, yeah, nunchucks can really knock you out and really hurt a person, take your head off and all that stuff like that. But you're not walking around with nunchucks. Regular stick and knife. You can adopt that to pretty much anything in your environment. You can take it. You can take a frying pan and something like that and turn it into a stick and knife fighting, the style that they teach. That's their weapon style. Okay. Now there's a couple of names they have, when I can't remember, but I know Cali is one of the names that they call it. There's another style Arnis. They have. It's called Arnis is another name of it. You're right. If you name it, I'll remember it. Okay. And you name it, I'll remember. That's right. Say it again. Screamer.
Right? Screamer?
Yep. It's yeah. called a Screamer too. A Screamer, Arnis, Cali, all those are Filipino. All that is stick. And the stick ain't even that long. It's like the size from your elbow to your shoulder. You know, it's not even a long stick. You know, it's like that. And you could do it with two sticks. You could do it with one stick. You could do it with a stick and a knife. The most basic style of it is called the hidden hand technique. It's an awesome technique to use in the protection of your life. And it's very dangerous. These dudes will cut you, literally cut you to pieces in a New York, you know, less than a New York minute. And so a lot of knife training that the Marine Corps does, and especially Special Forces, takes place in the Philippines. Okay. The other thing is also using the small, what do you call that? Karambit. Anybody familiar with a karambit? Karambit. A karambit is a small knife that has like a thumb holder. It's like a big hole at the end of the knife that you slide your thumb in. Okay. And you can swing it around. And then when you hold the knife, it's just a curved edge at the end of it. Sticks out like the tooth of a lion or something, like a saber tooth curved hook. Familiar with it now? If not, you can look it up. It's called a karambit. And there's different styles. You know, they've made so many different styles of them now. The Filipinos are masters of the karambit. Masters of it. And so the Marine Corps also takes... You understand what I'm talking about now, that sometimes the people will carry it around their neck. Sometimes they'll stick it in their waist. Sometimes it'll be on their wrist. And real quickly, they'll slide their finger in there. Also, fighting with your turban comes from the Philippines. Anybody see that style? You see the I call it the turban, but the thing that people wear on their heads. I wear them too. It's like made of cloth and has the stringy ends on it. A lot of times people wear them around their neck. Even you see Kufar nowadays, after their time in Afghanistan, you'll see them wearing it in Iraq. It's a little...
correct?
Yeah, the kufaya. Yes, taking the kufaya. Fighting with your kufaya. That also comes from the Philippines. When you put a kufaya, you know what they would do with the edges of those kufayas? They would slide a little rock in. Okay, it would drill a little hole in a rock or something like that, and then tie it into the stringy edges of one side of the kufaya, and then wear it loosely around their necks. And then if you came around them, they could take it off their neck real quick and swing it at you, like popping you with a towel. When you get popped with that end and it's got a rock at the very tip of it on those strings, what do you think happens? Nothing but blood. It's amazing how deadly that is. Just putting a small pebble at the edge of that, you know, you guys know what I'm talking about with the stringy ends of that kefaya, right?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Okay. They also tie a small knife, not even small, like razor, at the very tip, tie it into there, right there. And so when you pop that thing, cut you right away. Even without that, you know, if you get popped with it, it'll stop somebody in a fight, make them slow down, because just the pop of it, the whip of it. Now, can you imagine somebody tied to a couple of rocks at the end of it on those stringy pieces and a knife, a small, you know, knife no longer than a knuckle to your fingertip, you know, your top knuckle to your fingertip? Very, very dangerous. When it comes to sharp edges, Filipinos are dangerous. I don't know how dangerous they are up in the north, but if you see them walking around with machete, don't think you can get through with them. They'll chop you into pieces with that machete. Okay? And if you look up online, you can see some older Filipino people fighting with their machetes or with their short. Because the machete is from the teaching of the stick. See? The stick becomes sword. Same thing. Goes back and forth. They'll beat you up with the stick. They'll beat you up with a sword. They'll beat you up with a knife. And then when it comes to the empty hand, all the people, the boat people, that's what we used to call them, the people that are, you know, known to be Asians but not looked upon as being the Chinese, because they look at the Chinese and the Japanese as like Nazis, you know, big racist people. But these people are, you know, as they call it, Indonesia, you know, Malaysia, Indonesia, Brunei, Philippines, you know, those island people right here. Even the Vietnamese and those people like that, they all do a martial arts called silat, S-I-L-A-T. Now, silat is considered the most, you know, no-nonsense martial art around. Even people don't even, you know, realize it. You know, I noticed that there's a big racist thing in martial arts. They have this... You guys ever hear of that thing called Krav Kavag or something like that? The Jewish people like try to rave over, oh, he knows Krav Kavag. There is no such thing as Krav Kavag as far as like traditionally. It's just picking up martial arts from other styles. One of the main styles they've taken from, which is not a problem, it's just that it's a trick that makes you think that, oh, they came up with this. No, they did not come up with this. Jewish people did not come up with Krav Kavag. They just took it from Silat. And other martial arts, you know, which makes it a mixed martial art. That's all, you know. But it's all in the marketing, I guess. The ones that are so soft-spoken is the Silat. S-I-L-A-T. And if you do any research on that, you'll see that it's a very deadly martial art. It's a martial art that evolved with those boat people. Some of the people say it evolved because they were fighting headhunters and, you know, people who were, you know, cannibals and killing the Muslims. And so you'll notice that the style of it is very Islamic. You know, the starting form is standing in Salah, like with your hands in right hand over your left hand, as you're over your waist, like you're in Salah. And they say that it starts this way because the headhunters used to come and attack them when they were in Salah, because, you know, they figured they were distracted. So they would, let's attack the village. Let's attack the village while they're in Salah. Makes sense, though, right? I was a savage, and I wanted to attack a bunch of people. When can I attack them? Ooh, look at them. They're gathered together. They're really focused, looking down on their mats. So, have you ever seen Salat since you've been there? Salat since you've been there, Tyler Boyd?
No, I've tried so many times to find, but they don't teach – they don't teach these things here in this part of Philippines. It's here in the provinces.
You went to the worst part of Philippines, man. You went to the part where that, you know, Yeah, because, you know, the ones in the South, a lot of people don't realize either. The Filipinos in the South were known as pirates, too. Mm-hmm. Notorious pirates. You know, a lot of times the stuff that they associate to, you know, Aladdin and stuff like that. And those was Filipinos people. And also they were known as terrorists for a while. The Muslims in the South were notorious for defending their Islam down there. You know? Are you familiar with that as well, Mr. Boyd?
Yes, and actually, I've heard, Allah knows best, but I've heard that the English word boogeyman, it actually comes from, like, some tribe in this area that was, like, the boogie people who they used to, who were Muslim, actually, and they used to attack the Europeans when they would come. So the Europeans got scared of them, and they made a legend called the boogeyman, but it was really just a tribe of people.
Yeah, because they come out of the jungle, the swamplands, the, you know, the wetlands, and the middle of the night, and scare the doodle out these cats. And so, you know, a lot of those things are true. You know, a lot of those names, like I'll tell you, you ever heard of a Cockamamie clan? Where you come up with this Cockamamie clan? That comes from Cockatamamie. Okay. The great Tabi'in, his name was Ka'ka At-Tamimi. And he was known for his, you know, wild plans. He was one of the generals with Khalid ibn Walid. And he was like, yo, how do we figure it out? Go ask Ka'ka. He come up with a plan. And Ka'ka came up with a plan. So much so that the Kufar says, oh, man, they're going to come up here with one of those Ka'ka At-Tamimi plans. And that became Cockamamie. Okay, a wild, outlandish plan was called the Cockatamamie plan. And, of course, you know how people love abbreviations. And so eventually Cockatamamie, the tattled meek. So you say Cockatamamie, Cockamamie. So a lot of phrases in the that we have in idioms, as they say it, are true, really, really true. You know, even the thing I'd say is raining cats and dogs. That's a true statement. It comes from the fact that the people in Western Europe had straw roofs. And the dog and the cat used to go jump on the roof, you know, and sit up there at nighttime. And then what do you call it? When it rained, if it rained really, really hard, it got slippery for them and they would fall into the house. And so when they say when it's a hard rain, they call it, oh, man, it's so hard, it's raining cats and dogs. The dogs and the cats are falling into the house. So every time you have some of these phrases, there's a truism behind it. You know, it's a very, very big truism, you know. And because of that, you know, well, there's a lot of things that can be said about, you know, phrases and where they come from. But I like that. I'm going to look that up, the boogeyman. You know, I have no doubt whatsoever that it was named after a tribe or a group of people in a particular region in the Philippines, as you said. Because when I was in the military, people, when we had to go to the Philippines, some guys were like afraid because the instructors are very, very tough. In fact, supposedly the toughest reconnaissance unit in the world is reportedly the Filipinos recon. They're recon team. I'm going to Google it because I remember they held the record, Filipino. So there's a lot of stuff, you know, recon unit, toughest in the world. That's what I'm going to see what they say, toughest in the world. The world's deadliest Marine training, Special Forces, Filipino Marine Force Recon, so it's not their recon unit, it's their force recon unit. Yeah, that's what, and force recon is a lot more deadlier than recon, just to put it, you know, like that. Force recon.
What's the difference here?
Huge difference. Did you see that movie, The Bourne series?
I just heard about that recently. I didn't see it that far.
Yeah, it's called, I forget what it's called. I think it's called Bourne Supremacy or Bourne Identity. Yes,
yeah, Born like Identity, that. I think.
Yeah, he's Force Recon Marine. Okay? And what do you call it? They're talking about the unit that he's in. That unit is called SAD. Okay? Force Recon, generally, in countries, is the unit that, like, okay, you ever see, you ever hear about the CIA? The American United States has a group called the CIA. And yes, you hear about the CIA. But what you don't realize is that the killers, the assassins for the CIA are Force Recon Marines that have been sent TDA to the CIA. Whenever they need people for these intelligence units, because there's a difference between a commando unit. So you hear like the Navy SEALs, their commando unit and stuff like that. You hear about the Green Beret, they're a teaching unit. They go and they become, teach people how to revolt and stuff like that. The Rangers, is another commando unit and airborne and stuff like that. But Force Recon is an intelligence unit. So they go out with the intelligence because men, it's reconnaissance, are ninjas. So Force Recon are the ninjas of the country. Yes, they can kill. Most times they don't. Most times they do what? Gather reconnaissance. But Force Reconnaissance always does it behind enemy lines without backup and in small, small teams. But when they get the permission to kill, they never take hostages. Why not? Because they are too small of a unit to take hostages. So they became notorious for killing everybody. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
So, and Force Recon in the Marine Corps, the United States Marine Corps Force Recon, they're the ones that took over the role as pirates. Okay? So they're the ones that, and what do pirates do? They board your ship and take your stuff. Okay? We use another SH word when we say board your ship and take your sugar, honey, iced tea. And what do? They sink your ship or throw you in the water. Okay? That's the rules are everyone on board must die. Out in the open seas, there are no witnesses. Okay? And so if you still look up right now who the people who visit, they call them, they visit Force Recon, visits other ships, you know, they talk about that. You know, it's still the function of the Marine Corps while they're on ship. Okay. So part of the, you know, how what they do is board, visit, you know, attack, you know, other ships, you know. And they made an acronym of it nowadays, you know, but it's always been the VBS, visit board, and that's what it's called. I was trying to think of the turning. 1 second. It said, can you hear me, guys?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
It's called visit board search and seizure. That's the term that the Marines use for it now, the United States use for it now. Because people don't realize why these other countries hate the United States military, because they're still doing visit, board, search, seize. Okay? What does that mean? That means the U.S. Navy drives these Marines around. The Marines are the what? Pirates. And they visit. What a visit, huh? I always laughed at that term. Oh, we're just going to go visit another ship, guys. We'll be back in a few minutes. Okay? We're going to visit. You see, that's such a nice language, right?
That's a euphemism if I ever heard one.
Yeah.
They kill everybody?
Yes. That's right. There's not that many people on. There's not that many people on a shipping vessel. Mm. How many people are going to be on a shipping vessel anyway, bro? Think about it. How many people do you need on a shipping vessel? You need the people to work. Okay, you don't need that many. You know, you might have 20, 30 guys. That's about it. On a huge ship. Because the only reason you need that many is because you have shifts. You work in the ships. So you got the people in the engine rooms and stuff like that, making sure the ship doesn't break down and everything. You got the people cooking the food, and you got the people driving the food, and then you got the people that's on the side of the ship making sure like things are tied down and things like that. That's it. Security officer. You don't got nobody else on the ship. You don't need a whole bunch of people on the ship. It's not a cruise ship. Okay? So, you know, there's not going to be that many people there. And the rest of it is trade gear. And if you're going through any place in the open seas and you're not flying that NATO flag, Marine Corps is going to try to ram your ship and jump on your and steal your goods if they can get it. They have to kill everybody because then you're going to tell. Now, sometimes if they can report it and get help from their other people quickly or get it, you know, documented that they're being raided, you know, or visited, then like the Marines tried to steal stuff from North Korea so many times, but they don't get away with it. Because the North Koreans have a good communication and they see you. That's why you're supposed to get on a ship really fast before they see you. You know, we come with these rigid hull fast boats. You visit the ship, you board it, and now you can stop them. You know, now once you do that, if the North Koreans were delivering rifles and stuff like that to some of the enemies of the United States, and the United States took the ship, okay? And before they could take full control of the ship, the North Koreans called the United States and said, look, you better let our ship go. But they're delivering weapons too. We don't give a damn who your enemy is. We don't care. It's your business. Those people bought our stuff. We're going to deliver our stuff to them. It's your business. It's not our enemies. Let our ship go. America had to let the ship go or have to deal with North Korea. Thank you, because North Korea's like, you steal our stuff, we'll steal yours. So, you know, all the thing about it, what does it have to do with the Philippines? The Philippines, this is a weird place. They were notorious for stealing people's ships and bringing them down into those nooks and crannies in the Filipino islands, that if people were chasing them, they could disappear. They could take the boat and literally disappear in one of those lagoons and stuff like that with a whole ship, and nobody knows where they're at. Can't find the ship. So that's how they were able to maintain their wealth and their autonomy for such a long time. And still today, they still don't have a map of all the islands that the Filipinos have or all the routes, because it's like when you go down there, I've been there in those areas. Sometimes it looks like the water's shallow and then sometimes it's deep. So if you don't know where the water is deep, you'll get stuck. Your whole ship will get stuck. The people who know where to go, they can they can move in and move out, boom, boom. You can't. You know, so the Philippines is a very amazing place. You know. And I'm pretty sure you heard about everything I'm talking about there, Tyler Boyd, but you're up in the northern area. You know?
I'm learning a lot, Sheikh. When are you gonna come visit us?
I would like to come visit. You know, I haven't been there since I was when I was living in Japan. I went over, actually, my first month in Japan, after I was there about a month, I went to the Philippines right away. This was on schedule, and I showed up right in time for it. So, you know, that was those days. And it was very, very wild. Very, very wild. I learned that Manila is actually a Manila. I learned that. Did you know that?
Yes, I think you told me that before, Sheikh.
Yeah. So, I mean, I did know, and that to me was one of the most amazing things, that because I didn't never know that there were Muslims there. You know, okay? The NPA, New People's Army. I mean, I learned a lot when I was there about the people being Muslims, because one of the reasons I went to the Southeast Asia was because I didn't want to fight in the Gulf of Oman. So my old unit went to Oman and, you know, of course, Iraq and going to fight against the Muslims. I'm like, well, I'm confused about this. I'm not going to go. I'm going to ask for orders to Southeast Asia so I don't have to fight Muslims. we get to the Philippines, and they're Muslims. Like, what the? These guys are Muslims. I was so young in my Islam and ignorant about Islam. I had no idea that there were Muslims in the Philippines. You know, there was no internet. There was no, you know, knowledge of that stuff. You know, all the pictures of Muslims were Arab, right? So,
yes, sir.
Who's it now? Alhamdulillah.
So, when you went there, when you went there to Philippines, when you asked for these orders to go to Southeast Asia, you were going with the intention to fight, or you guys are just like, that's what military, they go there to fight, or they just go there to like be based there?
There's difference of orders, okay? So wherever you go, you're going to go fight. You think the Marines are going to have a people there? What are you based there for? You're based there to be in position to fight. That's what people don't mean. You're in strategic location to strike. Okay? What are you there to? We're here to be nice and cool. No. Every day you're training to kill somebody. So you're going to kill. You know what I'm saying? That's what you do 24-7 every day of the week. You know? So the thing about the Philippines is that there was a contract for a couple of bases, Subic Bay and Manila. You know, it was Navy bases. Marines were stationed there. But not everybody wanted the Marines there. And the Filipinos themselves were fighting. There's like three types of Filipinos. There's Catholic, there's Protestant, and there's Muslim. And they don't get along. Okay? And at that time, they were at war with each other. And there was a group called the NPA, New People's Army. And they were like, you know, and like the people in the South, that's still in the South right now. Do your research. I'm trying to remember the Muslim leader that's in South Filipinos. He's an awesome guy. I mean, he's the one that I took the quote from, that you're as young as your youngest wife. They saw him, he was like 60, 70 something years old. And he was like, how old are you? And he was in the interview. He was like, I'm as old as my youngest wife. He still got an army. Still don't listen to nobody. Still to this day. Okay? And
yes.
You know, I know they did an interview some years ago saying, yeah, we still here. We ain't gone. And we ain't, you know, weebles wobble, but they don't fall down. I was like, yo, people don't know that. You know, if you had to be like in the 70s and the 80s and know what a weeble was. It was this little toy that we had as children that was had a round bottle. You could punch it, knock it around, but it would never fall down. You know, so he's like, yo, weebles wobble. He's like, weebles wobble, but they don't fall down. You know, like, we may take a hit. And rock, you know, just what a seaman would say too. The ship rocks, but it ain't sinking, you know. It's a tough dude, you know. So, so we get stationed there so that you can kill the people that you don't like, that they don't like, you know. And the Marines are always killing people because they do not have to have a declared war to kill people. Only the Army does. Okay, only the United States Army, and they need and the Air Force, they need declarations of war from the president and the approval of the Congress. Marine Corps does not need the approval of the Congress. All they need is an order from the president. That's why it's called the Marine Corps. It's not an army. It's a corps of men. So legally, this is how they get around, you know, using deadly force or military force without a declaration of war. And the reason why they have a corps, because the Marine Corps is only for the use of the president. And it's to keep the president from being having a coup. Yeah, a coup by the army. So that's why whenever you see Trump or whoever the new, what's his name, Biden, you know, getting off a plane or something like that. Who are the guys that's around him? Marines. Whenever he's giving a speech in the background, what do you see in the background? Marines. The Marines are protecting the president. Even the guys in the civilian clothes, those guys are Marines. They are the personal protection of the president. Now, when he's driving on some of those streets, they have the special group that takes care of his ground transport.
Secret Service?
Yeah, those guys are doing like some of the parties and stuff like that. But the guys that are directly around the president are always going to be Marines, no matter what. Okay? Even if they look like they're civilians, those are Marines. Okay. So.
So I have a cousin. He's in Germany. Is he over there fighting though?
Depends. Now, Germany is a different thing. Germany used to be seen. That's an old base there. Germany bases, yes, there was fighting. During my time, there was lots of fighting. Why? Because you had East and West Germany. Remember, Germany just became one country. It wasn't one country back in the 80s and the 90s. It was two countries. East Germany and Western Germany. And they were at war with each other. And then stopped fighting each other until they tore the German wall, the wall down that was in between them. The people just got tired of it. And just one guy. I mean, it's a really amazing story. You guys should know military history. It's part of your FIP. You should know military history upside down. It is the history of the world. And most of it revolves around Islam, if not all of it. So if you want to tie, how does that tie to a FIP class? It is the FIP of the world. If you, and I've told you guys over and over again, start, learn the names of the prophets. That's first, that's world history. You know, not prehistoric, but you know, that's pre-modern time history. Then once you get to, you know, Abraha, everything is documented. Because from Adam to Abraha, there's splotches which you don't know about. Times that came and went. You don't know everything about it. You only know through the knowledge of knowing who the biographies of those prophets of those special times, the main points of history. And Allah has told you the main points of history by telling you the main people to focus on in history. But once you get to Abraha, you know, and you get to that particular time or Tab'an Asad, an actuality, you get to that time. And you get to Surah Al-Buruj. Now, every moment in history is considered modern because it's recorded. From that moment on, it's all recorded. And if you take the time of the Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, you do his seerah, you do the four Khulafa Rashidun, and then you start again with Abdul Malik ibn Marwan, and you record what other people were doing at that time. What was Rome doing at that time? What were the Genghis Khan and those people doing at, you know, at these different times? What was going on at these different times? Then you'll notice that you can follow all the way up to now just with Islamic history. Because almost every world battle since then has been based on Islam. I'll run it to you real quick. Just so we can Islamicize it. After the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam was born in his time, we go to Abu Bakr, we go to Umar, we go to Abdul Malik ibn Marwan. Now, Abdul Malik ibn Marwan is now the Khalifa. He's the first one to print money for the Islamic State. What were they using first? Roman coins. He tells the Romans, piss off, we're not using your money no more. Romans get mad. Okay? Now, Rome now is not southern Italy. Rome is Byzantine. Where is Byzantine? Where's the capital of Byzantine? Anybody know?
Turkey.
What's the name of the capital? Istanbul. There was no
Istanbul.
It was called Constantinople, but what's the modern name? Istanbul.
What?
The city of Istanbul. Okay? So we're talking that Istanbul, because Turkey as a country did not exist. There was nothing called Turkey. The people didn't even call themselves Turks. Okay? This only came after 1930 when they started pushing this term Turk. Prior to that, they did not use that term at all. They did not identify as one people. Okay? If anything, they were identifying as Mole, as Mongols. Okay? They were all tied to Genghis Khan and those people there. And this is why we'll go on further afterwards. So now, Istanbul is mad. It's the capital of the Roman Empire. It's saying, yo, these cats ain't using our money no more. They're not, you know, and they start they're not calling them crusades, but they start trying to make inroads on the Muslims again during this time. Who do they have to deal with? They have to deal with the Seljuk. Okay. Who was the first crusade? You now go to Buyuk Seljuk and you deal with Alp Arslan. Alp Arslan is one of the most famous generals in world history. This man, he fights the Persian Empire, okay, the Persian, Roman, what do you call it, Istanbul. He fights them. And he's fighting them. He's such a bad behind warrior. People think that he's going to be the one the Prophet ﷺ talked about. You know, that army is going to come and it's going to take over Istanbul, because the Prophet talks about Istanbul. The Prophet Muhammad ﷺ said, whoever conquers Istanbul is going to be a great general, and that's going to be a great blessed army of Allah. Alp Arslan is fighting these guys left and right. Okay? You have Sultan Turul, who set it up with him and his brothers, and then Alp Arslan takes over, and then they have the First Crusade, the Battle of Mezajik, and everything like that, where I think it's 100,000, you know, what do you call it, Romans to 1,000 men of Alp Arslan. And he comes out with the famous statement that, you know, blows away world history. They see him looking at the army. And you can look this up on kings and generals and all types of military history talks about these things. But because you're a Muslim, you'll understand the battles behind all of this. And they say, what are you looking at? What are you thinking about, you know, general or sultan? He says, I'm wondering, where are we going to bury all these people? He's serious. He's never once was his statement like, yo, man, that's a lot of guys. It's going to be a tough battle. No. His first statement is like, yo, man, I wonder where we're going to bury these guys. And so he sends a group of men on the other side of a mountain, and he tells them, start digging graves. He said, yo, a general has to have a total plan and be prepared for everything. We need to start making graves for these people. And of course, he kicks the living daylights out these guys. Okay? With his battle plans and everything like that. This is your history. You need to understand it. See the history, the battle plan that he laid down on them. Okay? And during the same time, the Mongols are getting stronger. And so now the Seljuk becomes strong. But what happens with the Seljuk? They start infighting left and right. They're infighting. And the Seljuk are partly Mongolian. That's Central Asian. I'm not going to call it totally Mongolian, but they're Central Asian. And the Mongols, people think that they just look like these Indian Chinese guys. No, it was Central Asians. That's why they were able to, you know, infiltrate everywhere, because the Genghis Khan's army did not care what religion you were in. You could be whatever religion you were. They didn't care what part of Central Asia you came from. They didn't care. That's why some of them look Chinese and some of them look half white. Okay, all the way up to Hungary. They didn't care. They were not racist. If you were a good soldier, you got paid. And so people were joining the Mongolian army left and right, because you got ranked based on your ability. Okay? So it was not like people show, oh, the Mongols, these crazy wild guys. There was a beautiful program on TV, on Netflix, that was about the Mongolian army. They made it about the Italian guy who was stealing their silk. But, you know, and then about the Muslim guy who tried to take over for a couple of weeks. And got killed because he was adopted and everything like that. But he supposedly went crazy when he found out that his mother was a prostitute, you know? So that program was one of the best programs they showed on how organized the Mongols were, how high of a society and modern the standard. They conquered everything all the way up to France. Prior to the Mongols going to France, Western Europeans did not wear pants. So now you learn, where did they get pants from? The Mongols. And if you look at all the pictures and drawings of the French before the advent of the Mongols, you don't see them wearing pants. The guys literally walked around with nothing on, or what they call stockings on their legs. And then after the Mongols, they have pants, you know, because horse riders and everything like that, they had the pants and everything. And so you see that as history is going, culture is being spread backwards and forwards, you know, and Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. So you keep going, and after the Seljuk, you have Salahuddin's people. You talk about the Kurds. Okay? When you have Sultan Nuruddin Zengi, he takes over in a southern area between Egypt, and he's not going down in Egypt, but he's between Egypt and Syria and these areas, Sham area, that end of the area down there. He's in that whole area, taking over that area and everything. And the Egyptians are Fatimid, they're Shia. And because he's, and this shows you, I learned so much from reading the history of Nuruddin Zengi about Aqidah. Okay? Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen, I went to war college before I went to, became, you know, teaching Islam or learning anything about Islam. I learned things about him before I even knew he was a Muslim, because we didn't learn it that way. We just learned about this commander called Nuruddin Zengi, and we learned that Zengi means Negro. And so he was like this dark-skinned guy from, what do you call it, Central Asia, but he was Kurdish, but he was black. And I was like, well, I was confused, but I said, again, nationality didn't mean anything. He, you know, who knows who his mother's and stuff like that. So a guy might have been from, you know, China, but had a black wife, and he didn't care. You know, he's just a beautiful woman. He fell in love with. He had a child. The child, Chinese cat with black Chinese kid, or a Kurdish guy with. They didn't care about those things. There wasn't this physical racism that we have today, you know, based on someone's color. You know, so. So he was called the Zengis. They were known for that because of their dark complexioned, you know, people. And, they come down, they take over this area. Now, why did I say he taught me a lot about Aqidah? Because the Fatimids were Shia. And when the Crusaders raided them, okay, because stupid Fatimids, they made a deal with them. And then afterwards they traded them and they started to kill them and was going to take over their land. What did the Fatimids do?
Sheikh, I think there's a show on YouTube about Nuruddin Zengi and Salahuddin Ayyubi. There's a show in Turkish.
Yeah. I realize they have a show about it now. I'm not going to say everything in the show is 100% true, but what you can do is you can pretty much every one of the battles is going to be true. That's what I noticed about what the Turks do. The Turks bring every one of the actual conflicts, and all they do is dramatize them. You get my point? Now, I heard that sometimes that after some time they start adding some things, you know, like, oh, he got away with this or this, that, and that stuff may not be true. They turn it into, you know, myth and legend. But where you follow that up is when you hear about the battle, go to this website or YouTube called Kings and Generals. Okay? And it will break down every one of those battles to you. It'll show you exactly what took place. And they've got other, websites too that show you how Salahuddin, or the history of Salahuddin in the area, how Salahuddin became the general in Egypt was because of what I'm going to tell you right now. Okay? So now Salahuddin and them, they did not have Egypt, but the Fatimids did. And the Zengi dynasty were, or the Sultanate, they were Sunni. When the Crusaders were attacking the Fatimid Shia, the Shia said, hey, you know, we're Muslim. Nuruddin, you gonna let them kill us? And Nuruddin sent his army down there between them and the Crusaders and protected the Shia. Protected them. Mm. Okay? Why? Because they're Muslim. Okay? And made an agreement with them. And eventually he sent Salahuddin down there, because Salahuddin's uncle became the commander down there to protect them, and he got killed or died. Salahuddin was appointed as the emir of the area to protect the area. And because of his character, the people converted back to the Sunnah. Okay? He's the commander there. Most of the people are Shia. But because of this guy's great character and everything like that, they start converting back to, or switching denominations and coming to the Sunnah, again until finally the Mamluks only known for being on the Sunnah. Because what Salah al-Din does, he picks up the same quality as the, he takes the battle strategy of the Mongolians. Because now while he's building this thing, the Mongolians have now decimated the Seljuks. The Seljuks are no longer the strong empire because the Mongolians have wiped them out. Okay? Pushing everybody eastern. Right? Even the Crusaders are afraid of them. And this is where the story of Ortogrul comes in, because they're amongst the people that are running away. So the K tribe from the Ortogrul series does the same thing the Mongols does, and Salah al-Din does the same thing the Mongols does. What does it do? And that's why the Kalar tribe became famous, because every time, you know, these people were tribal. Oh, this tribe and that tribe and my tribe and the Jandar tribe and this tribe and that tribe. Nah, the K didn't care. He said, yeah, we're the K tribe. But every orphan they found, they adopted and made him a king. You're K. Gave him all the rights of everybody else. Okay? Everybody that was abandoned, if they came upon them, you with us now. You're now part of the K tribe. So nobody lost any of their sense of identity, and nor where they felt feeling like they were outsiders. And that's why the K tribe was such strong, and their warriors were the most feared by the Mongolians, because they were the children. They were orphans. That most of the men in their army had their parents killed, raped, burnt to death by the Mongolians. So when the Mongolians faced them, they knew these guys were not going to budge. You got to kill them, because they're looking for revenge. And that's why the K tribe became notorious. And that's why they were so gentle with other tribes, because of who their men were. So what does Salah al-Din do? Salah al-Din, he takes these people who are running south now, coming south and everything like that. And now you've got all these, you know, ex-Seljuk people. You know what happens when the army breaks up? You got people who are in the military who turn themselves into little gangs. And so what they start doing, they start kidnapping people left and right. Oh, hey, slave trade picks up because the Mongols, you see, Mongols force the people to flee into refugees. They no longer have their fathers with them. They're strong people because they're fighting, trying to let their sisters and mothers and children get away. And these groups of these other military guys who are now just gangs are kidnapping everybody they can and selling them. And that's how a lot of the people got to India. And the Sindhi, some of those people were some of the people who were kidnapping people. And they were selling them to different left and right, up and down, sell them to the people in Istanbul, selling them to the people in the Mediterranean, to Greece and down to Syria, especially in Syria, which was a big, big place, selling them to Baghdad and places. And so that's why these places, this thing about Arab nationalism is such bullshit. You know, those people were so mixed. There's no one nation there. Half those people are Kurdish. You know, and then other ones, and everybody's mixed up with somebody else, and there were so many people coming in. And this is why you have that when you go back and you start reading the 100-year dynasty, and they talk about the woman who was the I think it was Murad's granddaughter, not his granddaughter by marriage, but from blood, but from marriage. I'm trying to think of her name, but she was a victim of, she was kidnapped off of one of the islands in the Mediterranean. As a white slave, okay, because they used to steal the white girls. And that's where this term called white slavery, okay? And they used to send the girls there because the Asians loved these white women. And so they would sell them, and that was a big deal to come in. They didn't like the women from the Caucasus. Now, the Caucasus, people don't realize Caucasus is Asian. You know, this whole thing where the Western Europeans say they're Caucasians, they ain't no Caucasians. Caucasus is a whole, it's 100% Muslim area still to this day. So those women were considered ruddy, you know, strong, rough looking women and stuff like that. So they didn't want those women from the Caucasus. They wanted them for service, but they wanted the woman, they wanted the Roman girls from Italy. They wanted the Greek girls, and they wanted the girls from the Mediterranean islands and from Spain, you know, that whole area like that. And they would steal those women, those European women and Southern European women, and brought them into the Asia, into Central Asia. Because, you know, Greece is right next to, you know, Jerusalem. It's not like it's far.
Syria and all of that is right there. People think it's some far away. No. Italy is so is just as much the Middle East as Egypt is. Okay? It's the exact same place, you know? But until you go there, you don't realize it's the same place. And so they are selling these people left and right. So what does Salah al-Din do? He's got all these slaves coming into Egypt because people are selling them into North Africa as well. And the North Africa is where you have the Amazigh people. That's why you find so many North Africans coming up with European blood. Even though they speak in Arabic, they're not Arabs. They're Amazigh, which is a North African grandchildren of Nuh, Prophet Nuh, coming out of East Africa. But there you find a lot of them have European blood because of their wars with southern Italy. And for so many years, and then their great warrior Hannibal went into there from that part and raided them. And because they kept having slaves and mixing and stuff like that, there's a whole society of people. But again, this comes through studying the history of the world and studying the battles. So now, Salah al-Din, what does he do? He takes all the slaves in Egypt and he says, any one of you men that want to fight, because he knows Genghis Khan is coming. He sees Genghis Khan destroying the Seljuk. He's coming east. He's coming. Eventually, he's going to come to Egypt. There's no way he's not going to come and sack Egypt. He goes to Baghdad and kills 10 million people. 10 million Muslims. Okay? And then what is he? Salah al-Din says, okay, we got to get ready for this guy. He says, any one of you guys who are here as slaves, you know, if you want to get out of your slavery, join the army. You join my army, we'll pay you. We'll pay for you your freedom. And as long as you're in my army, you're free. And so that's why those guys would just leave. They didn't need the permission of their owner. The only thing they had to prove that they could fight. And so he had competitions. And the people were coming and found out that a lot of those guys could really fight. They just were kidnapped, because a lot of them were kidnapped. They weren't born into slavery. They were kidnapped, you know? And he filled his army, and that's why his army was called the Mamluks, from the Arabic word milk, Mamluk. The fi'lul maf'ul. They were the possessions. So it says, you got a bunch of Mamluks. You got a bunch of owned men. And they're not. These are, you want to call them Mamluk? We don't care. These are soldiers. These are warriors. And he rode out with his warriors, and they're from all over the place. And that's why in that movie that you're talking about, where they're saying about Salah al-Din, if you note, they show his men, each one of them is a different nationality. And they keep making the point about that. That all of the men, even one of them is the same as the Roman people they're fighting from the exact same town. And city as them, and he's always in love with the Christian girl because that's what he was before he came Muslim. Those are his people.
I've seen that.
Yeah. And even have a black guy, they have everything. They make a point to show you that none of these guys are from the same place. All different people. That was Salah al-Din's strength. He took to say, oh, these Mongols got an idea here. You know? And then the Mamluks ruled Egypt for hundreds of years. Okay? They couldn't become the sultans, the ultimate sultan, like the Khalifa, because they had the stint of, oh, you guys are Mamluk, you're ex-slaves, this type of thing. So that was a political and social thing that hindered them from doing anything, but they maintained control of who would be in charge because there was the military back of it. And it became kind of like a perverted thing because of that. And we can see how that eventually failed due to us looking at where somebody comes from to be the leader as opposed to what his qualities are, you know? But now you see how we're moving through history in this way, okay? And then you could just how eventually what happens with Ortogrul in them. Ortogrul in them, and it's pertinent to understand geography today. Ortogrul himself, running away from the Mongols in the northern area, they go into Syria, right? And when they get into Syria, Aleppo and those places, they say to them, hey, you know, can we stay here? And the emir says, yeah, we'll give you the north. We'll give you the land in the north. What's so important about that land? In that land, now that's the doorway to go into where the crusaders are. So your land is going to be the first land that the crusaders come into. And on the left, the right hand side, it's the first land that the Mongols are going to come through. So the K tribe says, we'll take it. We'll take it. And that's how they become known as the frontier men, because they are fighting on their upper side. The crusaders, as the Romans come down and Istanbul is trying to kill them and stop them from settling there. And to their backside, they're fighting the Mongols who are coming and trying to, you know, tax them. And because the Mongols didn't kill everybody. They, once they killed enough people, they said, you guys rule yourself. Just pay us every week. Okay. You pay us every month. We will leave you alone. And part of the payment, their yearly payment, you had to give them women. Okay. If you go back and you read the contracts, they had to send Muslim women to the Mongols. And this was some of the tribes would do, and the K would never do it. Okay. Muslim women, a certain amount every year, because the Mongols needed women. They're an army. They need to have sex. And so this is what was going on. This is just the reality of war. And you still see it today. Ethiopia has a contract with the Khalij. They send them women. I have pictures. Okay. Every year they're sending them a certain amount of women. Israel just made a contract with Uganda and with, what's that country? Namibia. One of those countries in Southeast Africa. To send them 5,000 workers every year. That is a contract for slavery. This is a contract where the government is selling their people off to these other people. They're already getting money for it. Most of them are women. When they get there, what happens? They get raped. They get taken care of, advantage of. They get whatever happens to them. And, you know, you don't hear about it again. No one talks about it. You know? So even was the guy MBS, the guy who's the, what's his name, Mohammed something, Saud, Bisaud, what did he say? His mother's a Jew. From where? Ethiopia. She's this head lady in the house of his father. Okay? How does she get there? Well, she's the head lady at the house. She runs the castle now, but she started off as a servant. So yeah, that's his father and everything like that, but his mother's an Ethiopian Jew. Okay. And he talks about this in his, you know, when if you listen to what they say amongst themselves, when they gave Mohammed bin Saud this great award for being the friend of the Jews. I don't know if you guys saw that. He got an award from the Jewish community, the global Jewish community, as being the friend of the Jews. And they talk about his history and how his mother's, you know, a Jewish Ethiopian woman that still, you know, is not married to his father. But she has the highest position in the house, even over the wives. Because whoever the Bash Hatun is, that's the lady of the house, as they call it in English. She runs the house. She says who eats what, when they eat, who sleeps where, who cleans what room. You know, she runs the castle. So, alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen, gotta study history. So then what happens when Genghis Khan comes down to invade Egypt? He suffers his biggest and his first defeat by the Muslims. And it's the Battle of Ain al-Jalut. You can look it up too. The Battle of Ain al-Jalut. And this is when the history of Conan the Barbarian comes in. Barbarus and different people like that who are in this movie that you're talking about, the one here, they have some of the men there. They take over after Salah ad-Din because quiet as is kept, Salah ad-Din died the night before the battle. Okay? The night before the Battle of Ain al-Jalut, as Salah ad-Din's army went out to go fight and everything like that, and they set themselves up, Salah ad-Din was still in his tent, he dies. Barbarus and his men, those four generals that you see around him, they come out the tent, they say, don't tell nobody nothing. We're not going to depress our men. Now, you don't tell the men before the battle, the general, that's a superstitious thing. People are going to be like, the general's dead. What the hell are we going to do? Who's going to be in charge? Oh, my God. Who's, you know, they're going to be thinking about that. troops gain their strength from their generals too. So they don't say anything. They go into battle. You know, and there's a lot of things that happen during this battle. The women usually were the archers. The women filled the archer corps. They were the sharpshooters and stuff like that. And Genghis Khan's men killed some of the women. And one of the women was a woman from Sindh. And she was actually a princess that was kidnapped. And her husband was one of the generals of Salahuddin. And so he sees his wife get killed, you know. And he's like, look, I got all this armor on. My wife is getting martyred. He takes off his shirt. And he goes into, he continues the battle with no helmet on, no shirt on, fighting with swords. And again, the Battle of Conan the Barbarian is born, you know, when they talk about Conan, if you read the history, I don't know if you guys have heard, there was a comic book called Conan. There was a whole series called Conan. What people don't realize is Conan is Muslim. Okay. The author says, I would have made it clear. He writes in his memoirs, I would have made it clear that he was Muslim, but the reading world wasn't ready for a Muslim superhero. So he just wipes over the fact that Conan was Muslim. Okay. But it comes from, he's one of the soldiers of Salahuddin. Okay. And then of course he makes up all these, you know, fictitious stuff about him, but he's based on some of the battles and the expeditions of the soldiers around Salahuddin. Okay. And then he starts fighting every battle without no shirt on. Okay. Cause he's like, look, I'm ready to die. Just let's do it. You know, and just imagine you go into battle with guys got armor on from head to toe, and the guy standing in front of you has taken his armor off. He don't even have a shirt on. And you know, he's telling you, I don't even feel vulnerable. Okay. This is all our world history that comes from military history. In fact, I was reading an article. I'll try to find it, that the Masonic order invents superheroes, modern day superheroes, in order to hide real life superheroes. That was one of their, they're talking about how the invention of Superman and Batman and those other ones were the beginning of that, because these didn't have superpowers, right? But Superman and all those other ones, they start building these guys up and pushing them to children because they don't want people to have real life heroes. Okay, because if you see Superman, you know you can't do that. I can't fly, run faster than a speeding bullet, you know, and all this other stuff like that. So you have to suspend your reality. But when you learn the story of Salahuddin, when you learn the story of Berberus, when you learn the story of Alp Arslan, you know, when you learn the story of Sanjar, okay, Malik Shah, and these are real people. Their superpower was Dua. Okay? Their battle cry was Allahu Akbar. You know? And you listen to what they did and how they fought and everything. You can be energized by that and say, I can do that. That's in my history. I remember going, my parents had a vanity board. It's a wall that they put in the house where they put all their awards. It's like putting all your ijazas on the wall right there. Their degrees and all this other stuff, their letters of appreciation. They put it and plaqued it all over the world. The wall was full. And we would pass by it when we were going out the house. And sometimes, you know, you're not paying attention to it as kids. You're like, yeah, that looks great. Yeah, my parents. And then one day I was standing there looking at it, and I was noticing they had mixed them up. They had not put, like, my father's on one side and my mother's on it. And I just mixed them in there together. And it looked like any old way they had done it. So I was trying to figure out what the order was. Why the hell did they put it like this? And I saw some award that my father had gotten or my mother had gotten. I said, whoa, I didn't know I could do that. You see how the mind works? My parents' accomplishments energized me to say to myself, I didn't know I had that in me. I didn't know I could do that. And that's the same thing with history and the famous men and women in our history, how they acted, what their akhlaq was. When they were real people, you're going to say, man, yeah, that's what we do. That's what our OG, that's what we all about. Didn't you know? You didn't know about Hema Hatun? That's why they can't talk about people like Hema Hatun and different women. If you looked at the Iltutkl series and then you followed it up with studying, many, many times the women became the bey, became the temporary emir of the entire tribe when the men got into arguments about who's going to be in charge. It was automatically turned over to the head woman. And she would rule for years sometimes. Okay? Until they figured out how they was going to work it out, which man is going to take over the tribe. And this doesn't go against Islam. She just can't be the permanent leader. She can't make certain decisions. And so you don't find the kuffar being able to say that we oppress our woman then, can you?
That's right.
You can't say that. All right? And so even the story about how some of the Amazon ladies had come over to Central Asia, and they say this is how the women became the woman Arrow Corps in amongst the Seljuks, mixing with these people that they found out at sea, these Amazons. And everybody knows the Amazon woman. These women are about 6 foot. They're tall. They're muscular. They're beautiful women. And they're notorious for their warrior skills. Okay? And then you say, okay, it makes sense how the Seljuk woman or the now what we call the Turkish or Central Asian woman became these great, you know, arrow people, bowmen, archers, when you put into the context that a bunch of Amazon women got shipwrecked or stuck in Central Asia, and they made a legend about them. And the legend of Destan and the legend of these other, you know, women. I'm going to try to find the story, because then the women, they become, they take over an army and they attack in Central Asia and they become famous for it. Okay. But again, all this is documented history. And from that point on, you have, you know, the Muslims who organize and they attack in the, what do you call it? They attack what we call modern day, what is it called? The Constantinople. What's the name of it now?
Istanbul.
And they take it over. Murad II takes it over. And they change the name to Istanbul. Right? And now it's been Istanbul. It stays in Istanbul. It's considered the doorway to, you know, what do you call it? To Europe, and a doorway to Asia at the same time. Silk Road starts there. The Gold Road starts there. What do you call it? They go into Hungary. Who do they run into? Count Dracula. Count Dracula, the dirty bastard. What did he do? His father was the dragon lord, right? Lord of the dragons, devil worshiper and all this stuff. They take his sons, bring both of them back, put them into Quran school to try to rehabilitate these two children. One gets rehabilitated. The other one breaks out. So you learn quickly that Count Dracula went to the Quran school, okay? Memorized some Quran, grew up in the Mahdhar, goes back as a leader, gets sent back to Wallachia, and then says, to hell with all that stuff that I learned, and kills 25,000 Muslim men by impaling them, running a stick through their anus, through their mouths. 25,000. That's his declaration of war. Okay? Who do they send after him? They send his brother. They send his brother who actually accepted Islam. Doesn't make a difference. No, so Count Dracula is a real guy and he has these real problems. And they send someone who they send the Borro. They send the wild Turkish central guys, the ones that were still following some of the customs of the Mongols, but they were Muslims. But they still had all their, you know, wild, crazy, you know, stuff that they do, living out with the wolves and stuff like that. They send them out there and they kill this guy. Okay? And then afterwards, they named the modern day unit called the Borro, okay, after those guys. And still, what is it? I told you the Marine Corps, what do? They constantly, eclectically pick up everything, every unit that has been famous for something, they inculcate it into their force recon, MARSOC unit, Marine Special Operations unit. And so the motto of the new motto for Force Recon MARSOC is the strength of the pack is, the pack is with the wolf, meaning the wolf pack. And that was what the burro is. So even the motto that the Force Recon uses today, or MARSOC, I shouldn't say Force Recon, MARSOC uses today, comes from the Ottoman Empire, the Ottomani Empire, use of the burro, the group that went and killed, Count Dracula. And this was the motto they had used since before Islam about, you know, being wolves. They always described themselves as wolves and stuff like that because that was part of their culture. Okay? So when you study history, you'll see how everything is fitting together piece by piece, especially military histories, all tied together. Okay? And now we get to now. You know, and of course lies abound, but at least you have different contexts. There's another movie called Abdul Hamid Athani. Now his story, he's the one that fought the Masonic Order for 30 years. Okay? He takes over from like the 1800s and brings us up to 1915 approximately. Okay? That whole era, he covers that. And that's an important era. That's World War I, that's the beginning of World War II. You know, he's in this. When they finally kill him, who knows what time of day did he get killed? He got killed at Fajr time. Fajr. And so when he dies, he's the last Khalifa of the Islamic world. That's why he's important. Because they finally killed him. We're now naked. No Khalifa. Yes, someone can argue, well, there officially were two other Khalifas. One was in an insane asylum before they took him out and put him and made him the Khalifa. And that was the brother of Abdul Hamid. Okay. And they try to say, oh, he was just faking that because he was afraid of his brother Abdul Hamid. No, this is stuff that they say, that they made him a puppet. You know, and then that didn't last. They tried to put another one in, but then they just said, okay, we are firing all of these guys and we dismantled the Khalifa system. And they did. No more Khalifa. Why? Because during that 30-year war with Abdul Hamid, instead of just fighting us on the grounds of in the Caucasus Mountains, and that's why the Balkanization, that whole area is such important and such a wild area still today. Not only were they fighting us on the battlefield, they took the battle to fashion. They took the battle to education. They took the battle to the mind. And they won that war. Okay? And by winning that war was all they had to do. What they did, they drew the desire of the Muslim to want to imitate the Kafir. That was their whole strategy. How do we get these people to stop wanting to be Muslim and to look at us as superior and themselves and their way of life as inferior. Once they were able to do that, they were able to now criminalize the Khalifa. No, you need democracy. Everybody has to have a vote. This is not right having a Khalifa. He's a dictator. You know, look what he's telling you. You can't do, you can't try that. What if you want to drink? That's your opinion. That's, you can do whatever you want to. Allah didn't tell them that they could stop you. Right? He just said it's haram. So it's haram. Don't drink it. That's what you don't want to drink it. Don't drink it. Look at these super duper styles, lady. They hit up the ladies. Look at these styles. We're coming out of France. We got these new styles that you can like. Just check this out. Look at the dress. This is so cute. And the girls want it. And the stupid guys want the girls. And do anything. And everything because the women are up in their delusions and they want to help them in their delusional world because they want some sex. And still today, men do the same thing. I see men, why are you wearing a ring, brother? You know? Oh, because my wife. Oh, okay. So she's in charge? You know, men don't wear rings? Yeah, but, you know, yeah, but why? The mouth says something. The body does something else. You know? And the reasoning makes no sense. Now, I'm not talking about those guys who hold that, okay, the Prophet wore a ring and you're wearing a ring because imitation of the Prophet and he used it as a seal. So you're a businessman and this is your seal. So you don't put it on there and you're doing that because follow the Sunnah to do what the Prophet did for the reasons why he did it, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Not take what he did and just twist the meaning behind it. Totally different. Why are you standing up here with your hands in front of your right hand over your left hand, standing up here? Oh, because the Prophet did it in Salah. Well, doesn't mean that's what you're supposed to do right now. You know? Well, because he did it, that means we could do it. Not it. We don't say that. So we do what he did for the reasons why he did it. We don't hijack the reason and say, well, that just means we can just do anything that he did in any way for any reason. You follow me?
Yes, Chef.
Yes, sir.
Naam. Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen. So, we started off talking about Philippines. And we're still talking about the Philippines. We're talking about understanding history in light of military conquests and how that is actually the real history that has documented all the world and that all of it is tied to Islamic events. And our subjugation, our weakening, and why, and the fiqh behind that. So it's very important, in my estimation, that you guys, and that's why I like the Turkish series, because it is the only expression of the history outside of writing that anyone has seen, okay, except the side of the Kufar. Meaning, we grew up hearing the side of the Kufar. We heard from the British, they said, we heard from the Americans, the French, the Russians. We never heard from the Muslims what happened. We never heard their perspective, their point of view, their expression of the history. Well, by listening to this Turkish series, you're going to hear all of that. You're going to see it from the perspective of the Muslims. Now, first thing you find some of the enemies of Islam who are in Islam saying, and they have become the Bathaniya. You start to see who the Bathaniya are. You won't even learn. You hear about the Bathaniya when you read the books. Like, I first heard about the Bathaniya from the books Ihya ul-Muddin from Imam al-Ghazali. But it didn't mean anything to me technically because it was just theory and a book. But when I saw the movies and I saw how the Bathaniya were, I realized, hold on, I heard about this guy when I was a child learning, because I was going through military, semi-military academy when I was a child, and I learned about the word assassin and Hassan Sabbah and how he is the one was that founded the assassin, you know? And as they say now, the Assassin's Creed, this is from the Muslims. The actual word was hashashin, okay? The people who smoked and burnt hash. And so they become, and this is Hassan al-Sabbah. And his whole time, he's fighting Nizam al-Mulk and Sanjar and Malik Shah. And, you know, and these things like that. And you're like, oh, subhanAllah, this is what they're talking about? And even events I read about, I saw in the movie. I read about them when I was a young child, meaning going into teenagehood. And then I saw them and said, oh, subhanAllah, I remember this. And I remember how I had pictured it in my head as a child and how I saw it now was a little different. Okay? But it was a cliff battle and I had imagined it totally different as a child because it was just in a book. We didn't have internet, you know? So seeing that again, confirming that, understanding who the Bathaniya was, that now when I hear Muslims or people who claim to be Muslims, I can see that they are blatantly Bathaniya. Blatantly Bathaniya. But if you have no experience seeing the Bathaniya, you don't know who they are, how they operate, and what they've done historically, you don't notice them. But when you have, they're blatant. They're right there in your face. And these are those Muslims who come out and say they're Muslim and they're talking for Islam and they look like Muslims. And then a little bit later, after you've accepted them, they stop looking so much like Muslims. Or they keep looking like Muslims and they start their speech starts to change. And everything they say, it seems to be the same thing that the Kufar are saying. Of course, for different reasons.
They give Islamic reasons why you should go ahead and snort coke. I'm just being facetious. But that's how far they go. Okay? Because the objective from the time of Abdul Hamid was, don't deny that you're Muslim. Just deny the applicate that you have to apply your Islam. You know, because we can't beat them by saying stop Islam. As soon as we say stop being Muslim, we lose. The Muslims rise up against us. So we won't say stop being Muslim. You can't beat them, join them. Let's join them. Let's tell them what to think. Let's focus them on fighting each other. And let's redefine what it means without saying that we're redefining it. You guys understand that?
Yes, yes, sir.
It's like Imam Al-Ghazali, I think, was also, I came across that book about his biography as well.
Okay.
About the people you said and how they came in faking to be Muslims, and Imam Ghazali exposed them by his theology and how they were wrong.
Right, the Bathinia. See, when what do you find is when I first came to Islam and started to become a Talib al-Ilm, what's the first thing they tell you about Imam Ghazali? Anybody? What they tell you is that Imam Ghazali is a Sufi. He's a heretic.
Yeah,
he's.
I was gonna say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, why don't you say it then, Bear? Say it. Let me hear it. What did
I wasn't
you
hear? Sure. Yeah, they. It's. Ya Allah, Subhanallah. They say that he's like just like you said, he's a Sufi, or that he's, you know, a pandita or something like that. But
he's off it. They can't even pinpoint what they're saying. But because you're new in Islam, you just feel that, hey, they're telling you to stay away from this guy. There's this whole huge effort to say, hey, don't listen to Imam Al-Ghazali. He's a weirdo. He doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. You can't, and his works are too erudite. He's like he was smoking weed himself and writing in the dark. You know, don't listen to this guy. And you're like, whoa, I don't know, but I'm going to stay away from this guy until I learn better. That's the mentality. I was like, whoa, I don't, you know, something don't sound right, but, you know.
It scares you away.
Yeah. You're like, oh, I don't, what the hell, I'm not going to mess with this guy. And then when you study his actual history, and you see, for me, it was Nizam al-Mulk, because the CIA and the intelligence service in the United States, they formed their organization off of watching Nizam al-Mulk, the famous assistant to Al-Aslan, the famous assistant to Malik Shah, okay? The mentor of Sultan Sanjar, and the arch enemy of the Bathinia. Nizam al-Mulk is the one who appointed Ghazali over the Nizamiya schools. And the Seljuk was super Sunnah. So how is this guy going to be a Sufi, a heretic? That's when I realized that, hold on, there's something wrong here. And then when you go and you study the history and you realize that Ghazali was the student of Imam al-Juwaini, which we get a lot of our Usul al-Fiqh, Imam al-Haramain, you say, hold on, how does he take over for Imam al-Haramain, Imam al-Juwaini, the one who wrote the book Al-Waraqat fi Usul al-Fiqh? This doesn't make sense. How he's, you know, because they didn't, if he was such this heretic, how did he get these positions? When you realize that he was put together to be the judge, to judge the Sultan's children in court. You say, yeah, this dude was all of that. And that was as a young Qadi. He was a young dude at that time. And you find out, you say, okay, something's wrong here. Then you go back and you read and you see the history and you realize that
Imam al-Ghazali put his foot straight up the Bakhtiniya's backside. He destroyed their theology. They had people tricked and were able to out-talk people with the Jedi mind trick until Imam al-Ghazali opened his mouth. And he was so smooth with it. So he read all their books. When they busted someplace and they found their books where they were teaching, and he was about to burn it. Oh, we're going to burn this stuff, you know. And he said, no, don't burn it. Give it to me. In fact, the people that wanted to burn it were Bakhtiniya because they didn't want them to fall into the hands of the people, the Muslims. So they want to get rid of it. No, give me those books. What are you going to do with them? It's their doctrine. It's their magic. You can get sick from this stuff. It might hurt your heart. Give it to me. He takes it. He reads it. He reads it all. Internalizes it. Understands where they're coming from. All right, I got you. Now they can't out-talk you. They can't do it. Again, you won't get this unless you know the military history. You won't get this only reading it from the European state of mind. And that's why I'm glad they didn't translate these things into dub into English. No, it should be in Turkish. That was the language of education. Arabic was the language of your Islamic studies. Turkish was the language of your government. Persian was the language of science. It only stopped being that so that it could make you ignorant. And then they made their own set of educators, and they call it the PhD program, which is really a piece of trash. It's nothing to do with the Islamic way. The Islamic way is 10 times harder. I'll give you an example. We memorized the Quran, 604 pages. And that, we don't still consider that a PhD. What the hell's wrong with you? How are you thinking? You telling me a man that has memorized 604 pages of Arabic perfectly, because you can't get a 95. You can't get it wrong. You can't say Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. No, it's got to be Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Every word has to have the right tajweed, has to have the right fatha, dhamma, kasra. 604 pages, 15 lines on every page. You understand what I'm saying, guys? And you say that's not a PhD?
Yes.
But a guy writes, he writes something, his theory, his master's theory, his PhD theory, and he articulates that, and then, that's supposed to be a PhD? No. Look what we have to do then. Then we have to learn all the rules of tajweed and qira'ah for that particular qira'ah. Right? And that takes memorizing poetry. Then we have to learn all the rules of Arabic, all of them. That's memorizing 1,011 lines, 1,011 lines of poetry in Ibn al-Malik, right? That's not mentioning Ajrumiyya, Lamiyya Tilaf'al, which is another 60 lines, 100 lines over here in there. Poetry of Jahiliyya. This is fun, but then I know a guy who took the introduction from Al-Ajrumiyya, translated it, and got his master's degree from the introduction. He got a PhD. What do you think he should get then from doing the whole Quran? You understand what I'm saying, guys? We have twisted our heads up to look at their PhD program as though it's greater than our Islamic program, where an Islamic sheikh is 25, at least 25 times a PhD. When he memorized the Lugha, he should have got a PhD. When he finished the Quran, he should have got a PhD. When he learned the rules of Usul al-Fiqh, he should have got a PhD. When he just finished basic fiqh, when we talk about learning 38 rules of law, you get a PhD in America for that. They call that your judicial license, right? You learn the laws in the United States, you get a JG, a judicial adjuster, judicial justice. It's a PhD in law. Then why isn't he getting a PhD? The faqih. But they teach us to look down on our education and to aggrandize theirs. Who teaches us the Bataniya? Those fake Muslims that are pretending to be Muslims. Well, how will we know them if you don't know history? Do you understand? They tell us that their doctors are the best in the world. We should trust them. Do you know that almost every medical surgical tool in the world that's used in medicine today for medicine for healing people was invented in Andalusia? Did you know that? Almost every last one of them. Maybe they've come out with maybe 5 new ones in the last 100 years. But besides that, all the rest come from Andalusia. What does Andalusia represent? The opposite side of Baghdad. You had Baghdad in the east and Andalusia in the west. 2 extents of the Islamic world at that time. So that we know of. Because they had the scorched earth policy in South America. And what we noticed about South America was the scorched earth policy. Do you guys know about that? The history of South America?
No, sure.
No.
2 main things that they tried to cover up. But it's like really blatant when you go through any half behind research on it. 1 is that how many actual giants lived in that side of the world? Literal giants. We're in South America, the Americas. 2, that they burnt every piece of paper and every sign of society in South America. They killed everybody that was a teacher. They took every piece of governmental literature, destroyed it. They destroyed everything that spoke to the society. What language did they speak in South America before Spanish? Exactly. What was their writing style? Do we have any paperwork from them? What were their kings called? What were their leaders called? What was? No clue. Why? They burnt and destroyed every stitch of community and civilization. The only things that remained are the things they couldn't destroy. And that was the pyramids and the great monuments that they have. And now we're like left with, how did they do this? What is this all about? You know, they go and look at it and says, oh, it had to be done in the Stone Age. But how could it be in the Stone Age when this thing is razor sharp and laser fitted? And, you know, we can't even see how they move these tons of rocks. And where's the quarry is 100, 200 miles away. There isn't even a road, and no sign that ever road was ever existed. How did these things get there? How is it that the pyramids in Mexico are exactly lined up with the ones in Egypt and the ones down in Sudan? How is that? We can't find out because they burnt every stitch of information. Not even the letters remain. And we don't talk about that. We don't talk about it because Europeans control the narrative. Of course, they're not going to talk about it. Do you understand what I'm saying, guys?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Have you ever thought about that? Or have you thought that the language in South America was always Spanish, as they want you to think?
I thought... I always wondered about them. I was very curious about that group of people, across South America, because, like you said, I remember thinking about that probably like a couple months ago. I was like, I don't know anything about that part of the world.
Now, there's 2 things you will notice. Not only there were giants, there were little people too. So you still see a lot of the little people. They're extremely short people. The people in the language. Some of the words have remained. You find some, like the word coyote and avocado and certain things like that, that come Those are all, you know, native words that are not from Spanish that have stayed about, like certain, you know, names of animals and fruit and vegetables and stuff like that, as that's harder to get rid of, you know. But the scorched earth policy, it is spoken about by some Spanish writers. But again, if you only study in English, you'll never even, well, there's one English writer. There's only one English writer that I ever saw write about it. Okay. There goes some problem. Besides that one, I've never seen any, English writer discuss the genocide of South America. Okay. And that's why whenever something happens, like when they found recently, not so recently, but what's his name? Abdullah Hakim Quick. He was showing how when they found some ships sunk in the Gulf of Mexico, it became a very, very big national issue for American society when they called it a national security issue. Where they had to take over the site because this is an old barge, an old ship that predates the conquistadores. Those are the ones they sent there, the reconquerors, which is basically the crusaders, the same people that had entered into Egypt as well. And you'll hear them saying, from the shores of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. Montezuma is in Mexico. Okay? This is the Marine Corps anthem. From the shores of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, we will fight our country's battles on the land, on the air, and sea. But people say, well, they miss it. What happened to Montezuma? What was the Battle of Montezuma? What did they do there? They don't talk about it unless you study, you know, the battles. And then you'll realize how the Marine Corps went down there and murdered everybody. Everybody. The only ones they left were women that were able to have sex and have babies. They even killed old ladies because they didn't want them to tell them stories. Okay? That's how they justified killing the elder women. They said, well, let's leave the grandmothers. No. Kill all anybody who has memory. We kill them. Right? Because we don't want them even telling them stories about this stuff. Right? And we keep the girls that we can have sex with. These are the teenage girls and stuff like that. Not too old. Because as long as they're childbearing, so we can do what Fir'aun did. And this is why the story of Fir'aun is so profound. It's not just talking about Musa. It's talking about what they do always. All these Fir'aun do. Destroy the population, the male population. And only keep enough that they can enslave to do labor for them. Okay, import other people to where they've displaced and put them there so there won't be a land-based memory. And if there is a memory, it's tied to another land. So this is why the refugee program of the UN, where they take people from Palestine and they pay for them to move to South America. Did you know that? That the United Nations has been paying for people in Palestine, buying their homes and paying them money to move to South America for like 30, 40 years. And since the 60s, so it's 50 years now. And so you find a whole bunch of Arabs people there. But you'll think that because you find Arab names there, it's because those Filistino people. No. How haven't you noticed how many people in South America have Muslim names? Medina, Omar, and all these type of names like that. Where do you think all those Latinos peoples in South America got all these Muslim names still in their culture? We don't know because we can't pin it down. But it looks like there was a Muslim population there. Then they did such a good job that the murder and the scorched earth policy, you know, unless some new information comes up, we don't have it. And then would we be able to read it, right? Anyway, this is my encouragement for you, because it takes some time to learn all these things, to study this history. It takes time. It takes dedication. I remember reading and watching the movie from Abdul Hamid some years ago. I mean, so many years ago, I was in Florida. Okay? And subhanAllah, I could not, I got to a point where I couldn't watch it anymore. It was so depressing. Seeing how the Muslims were taking off their thobes and wanting to buy, you know, British shirts and things like that. And wanting to wear the Masonic collar. You know, before Muslims did not wear collared shirts. And that's why when you see the Iranians, they never do. Right? Even now, when you see the Iranian and delegates and stuff like that, they wear the Nehru collar. We don't wear the pointed collar. That was a British thing. That was a Masonic, a sign of the Masons. And so anybody who wanted to look like an up-and-coming Mason, he could buy one of those things, you know, and wear it in that way. But the Muslims wouldn't do it. Now, I remember when in the 80s, late 80s, early 90s, a company said, hey, let's put collars on the thobes. And the ulama went into a, oh, what do you mean putting collars on the thobes? You can't put a collar on a thobe. That's oxymoronic. You can't put a collar on a thobe. And they said, well, you know, it means it's from the masonry. That was its origin, but it doesn't mean that anymore. And and they did it. You don't got to buy it. And for a while, nobody bought it. Only a few people, you know, they bought it. Now, 10 years later, people started buying it. More people come to Islam. Next generation comes up. They don't know. They didn't even know it wasn't even an issue. What the hell is that all about? And now people have collars on the thobes. They call that initiating people. People are getting initiated. They don't even know they're being initiated. That's what they do with the music. And they have the people put their hands into like the V and cover one eye, not knowing that this is a devil worshiping routine or, you know, ritual. But the rapper did it. The singer did it. Oh, I'm like that. I'm just like OJ Simple, whoever the guy is. I don't just throw names out. Initiating the people. How do you not get initiated? Study your history. Be dedicated. Part of your fiqh. It flavors your mentality. You agree or disagree?
I agree, Sheikh.
Okay,
well then, it should tell you what you should do with your evenings. Because the way I inculcated it in is in my evenings. First, I watched all the Turkish shows in the world. Not the Turkish shows, but the Turkish historic pieces, which entailed me learning Turkish. Okay? That's what it does. I paid for tutors. I went to myself. I went to school for learning Turkish, took 2 semesters of it myself. You know, sent my children to school for it. Got my wife a tutor when she needed one. Then my wife, now she teaches Turkish. Okay? So if your wife needs a Turkish teacher, my wife is open. But I'm teasing. But I'm telling you the truth at the same time. You know, in order to help me understand what's being said to me. And so that I could understand. And then I watched those movies. And then I just watched the movies. Every conflict, I looked it up. But I looked it up after I saw it because I didn't want to ruin the movie for myself. Okay? I didn't want to ruin it because I did that the first season with Ertugrul and it ruined it for me. So then afterwards, I said, okay, slow down. Watch it, enjoy it, look it up. Watch it once the conflict is over, look it up, see how it actually went down. There may be some differences, and there are some differences because, you know, that the program wants to make it excited, and so they dramatize it, but you still get some benefit out of it. You get a lot of benefit out of watching the show. You learn so much. And it changed my life. And this is one of the reasons why I moved to Turkey in the first place. Okay? Because of that. All right. That's my my not promoting Turkey, but I'm saying that's my like I said, I'm not saying Turkey is the best world in the world. Even reading the story of Ataturk does wonders. I used to hate Ataturk, but after watching his movie and reading his seeing his documentary and things like that, I believe that Ataturk was a great thing for the Muslims. Some people say, how could you like Ataturk? He killed so many Muslims. He was the lesser of the two evils. If Ataturk hadn't done what he did, then the Greeks and the Americans and the British would have invaded, or not just invaded, they would have stayed in Turkey. But they wanted so much to watch the Muslims kill the Muslims. They backed up to let Ataturk do it. So Ataturk did it. Okay? He did. He was the butcher. He did all the things that they blamed him for. But the beautiful thing about it is, as soon as he was gone, the Muslims turned back into Muslims. I mean, it didn't last. And it would have been different if they would have been colonized. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
You know, so when you had the choice, it's better to keep your autonomy than be colonized by somebody else who's going to try to maintain that control by bringing new people in every couple of years. Alhamdulillah. May Allah make it easy. And now we have Erdogan there, who is, alhamdulillah, may Allah bless him and continue to guide him and strengthen him so that he can do better. You know, alhamdulillah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.